Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this age of climate chaos and COVID-19, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the issues that matter most. We count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Gave just $4, we could cover our operating costs for 2022. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Oh, and stay safe, wear a mask, save lives. Thank you so much, and happy holidays. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I, Sandra Prunella Mason, do swear that I will well and truly serve Barbados in the office of president, so help me God.
Barbados has become the world's newest republic, breaking ties with Queen Elizabeth 55 years after it became an independent nation. Calls are now growing for Britain to pay reparations for centuries of slavery and colonialism. We'll go to Bridgetown, Barbados for the latest. Then we look at World AIDS Day.
On World AIDS Day in 2021, we want to think about the more than 700,000 people who died of AIDS in the United States and the 35 to 40 million people who died of it globally. But we also want to think about the fact that more than 800,000 people have already died of COVID-19 in the United States, surpassing the number of people who have died of HIV and AIDS. And we want to think about what it means that so much death and suffering and mourning of four decades has been compressed into less than 2 years.
But first, workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, may soon get another chance to decide whether to unionize. The National Labor Relations Board has ordered a new election after it ruled Amazon had interfered in the first election in part by pressuring the U.S. Postal Service to install a mailbox outside the warehouse one day before the voting was set to begin.
Workers just truly believe that something is going on with this mailing box that why would Amazon want them to bring their ballots from home and bring it to the plant and put it in their mailbox when they can just literally put it back in their own mailbox?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Omicron coronavirus variant has been identified in at least 20 countries as more governments move to impose travel bans and other restrictions to curb its spread. This comes as new evidence shows the highly mutated variant was present in the Netherlands at least several days before it was first detected and reported to the world by South Africa. Two flights on Dutch airline KLM may have been super spreader events for the Omicron variant. In other coronavirus news, an FDA panel voted by a narrow margin to endorse the use of Merck's antiviral COVID-19 pill. The oral treatment, which was shown in trials to reduce severe illness and death, could be approved for patient use within days and available within weeks. In legal news, a federal judge has blocked the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for health workers. The requirement was scheduled to take effect next week. In Michigan, a 15-year-old student opened fire at Oxford High School near Detroit, killing three students and injuring another eight. The three students who were fatally shot were 14, 16, and 17. The suspect is now in custody, but no motives for the rampage have been released. It was the 651st mass shooting in the U.S. this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. In Washington, D.C., Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy blasted his Republican colleagues on the Senate floor for blocking gun control legislation.
At the very moment that moms and dads in Michigan were being told that their kids weren't coming home because they were shot at school due to a country that has accepted gun violence due to Republicans' fealty to the gun lobby. Do not lecture us about the sanctity, the importance of life when 100 people every single day are losing their lives to guns, when kids go to school fearful that they won't return home because a classmate will turn a gun on them, when it is in our control whether this happens.
The father of the 15-year-old shooter in Michigan had bought the gun he used several days before. In other gun control news, a federal court in California upheld the state's ban on high-capacity magazines Tuesday. Further challenges to the California law could see the case brought before the U.S. Supreme Court. On Tuesday, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection questioned Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who then President Trump called in January, asking him to find some 11,000 votes that would put him ahead of Biden in Georgia's election tally. Raffensperger refused to help Trump overturn the results. The committee is expected to move forward today with criminal contempt proceedings against former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark for refusing to comply with a committee subpoena. The full House would then have to vote in favor of sending the matter to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution. Meanwhile, Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff under Trump, has handed over documents to the House committee and will testify before the panel. In related news, Meadows has revealed in his new memoir that Trump tested positive for COVID-19 3 days before his first debate with Joe Biden in September 2020, but went on to the debate and other public events without revealing his positive test publicly. The U.S. government's revoked its designation of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, as a foreign terrorist organization. It's been 5 years since the FARC and the Colombian government signed a peace accord after 5 decades of conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said removing the terrorist designation would facilitate U.S. support in implementing the accord. A new report published by Human Rights Watch says Taliban forces have executed or forcibly disappeared some 100 former Afghan security forces since taking over Afghanistan in August. The report documents the killings of at least 47 former members of the Afghan National Security Forces who'd surrendered or were apprehended by the Taliban between August and October in 4 provinces. At least another 53 former security force members were also killed. In a statement, Human Rights Watch said, quote, the Taliban leadership's promised amnesty has not stopped local commanders from summarily executing or disappearing former Afghan security force members. The burden is on the Taliban to prevent further killings, hold those responsible to account, and compensate the victims' families, they said. A warning to our audience, this story contains graphic descriptions of violence. In Germany, a Frankfurt court has convicted a former member of the Islamic State of committing genocide against Iraq's minority Yazidi community. Taha al-Jumaili was found guilty of crimes against humanity and war crimes and sentenced to life in prison. The case involved the killing of a 5-year-old girl who al-Jumaili bought as a slave along with her mother in 2015 in Syria. They were then taken to the Iraqi city of Fallujah. The girl died after being chained and left in the hot sun without water. The mother survived captivity and testified at the trial. The landmark trial is the first time a person has been convicted for their role in the brutal persecution carried out by the Islamic State against the Yazidi religious minority, a Kurdish-speaking group, which the UN denounced as genocide. French President Emmanuel Macron inducted American-born pioneering performer and civil rights icon Josephine Baker into the Pantheon on Tuesday, considered France's highest tribute. Josephine Baker is the first Black woman and first American to receive the honor. This came on the same day that far-right xenophobic writer and pundit Eric Zemmour announced he would run for president. Zemmour has repeatedly attacked Islam, immigrants, and the left. He relied on his usual racist talking points in a video announcing his candidacy.
You haven't moved out, and yet you feel like you're no longer at home. You haven't left your country, but it is as if your country has left you. You feel like you're a foreigner in your own country. You are exiled from within.
Back in the United States, a group of Democratic lawmakers held a news conference Tuesday amidst the outrage over anti-Muslim attacks by Congressmember Lauren Boebert and other Republicans against Congressmember Ilhan Omar. Omar again called on Republican leadership to hold party members accountable for their dangerous rhetoric.
The truth is that Islamophobia pervades our culture, our politics, and even policy decisions. Cable news hosts, leading politicians in the Republican Party routinely spout hateful rhetoric about a religion that includes a diverse group, more than a billion peaceful worshipers around the world.
Congressmember Omar also played a threatening, profanity-laden voicemail she received this week.
You will not live much longer, bitch. I can almost guarantee you that.
The call came after Boebert refused to apologize to Congressmember Omar Monday for making Islamophobic statements, including calling her a member of the Jihad Squad, talking about her wearing a backpack or concern that she would not be wearing a backpack. In 2018, Ilhan Omar became the first Somali American and one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. The Supreme Court's hearing arguments today in a pivotal case that could overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling and the constitutionally protected right to have an abortion. The case Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization is a challenge to Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. Reproductive rights defenders are demonstrating in front of the Supreme Court today. CNN has indefinitely suspended star anchor Chris Cuomo for advising his brother, disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, on his response to mounting accusations of sexual harassment. In a statement, CNN said documents released Monday by New York Attorney General Letitia James revealed Chris Cuomo had, quote, a greater level of involvement than we previously knew, unquote. The CNN anchor repeatedly offered advice and assistance, including using his contacts to check on the status of upcoming articles about then-Governor Andrew Cuomo. In Minnesota, jury selection began Tuesday in the manslaughter trial of white former police officer Kimberly Potter, who in April fatally shot Dante Wright, a 20-year-old black man and father in Brooklyn Center. Potter can be heard in body cam video shouting "taser" multiple times before she killed Wright. The police officers initially pulled Dante Wright over for minor traffic violations, including an air freshener hanging from the car's rearview mirror. In California, a new report estimates at least 1,500 unhoused people died on Los Angeles streets from the start of the pandemic to July 2021. The most common cause of death was accidental overdose. In related news in New York, city officials announced the opening of at least two supervised drug injection sites here in Manhattan. The locations offer clean needles, administer naloxone, an opioid reversal medication, provide medical care and drug dependency treatment options. The advocates have long fought for better and safer resources for people with addiction. The government-approved facilities are the first of their kind in the country and are aimed at fighting a rise in overdose deaths. U.S. overdose fatalities topped 100,000 over a year period ending in April, a record number. A warning to our audience, the story contains descriptions of child sexual abuse, and Phil Saviano has died. The survivor of clergy sex abuse and whistleblower was central in bringing to light decades of sexual assaults by Catholic priests. The scandal led to the resignation of Boston's Cardinal Bernard Law in 2002 and the church settling with hundreds of survivors. Saviano's story was featured in the 2015 Oscar-winning film Spotlight on the Boston Globe investigative team that helps expose scores of cases of priests sexually assaulting children. Phil Saviano was 69 years old. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, on Black Friday, one of the busiest shopping days of the year, the day after Thanksgiving, Amazon employees worldwide joined in a strike that targeted the trillion-dollar company and its founder, billionaire Jeff Bezos, under the banner Make Amazon Pay. They called for the retail giant to raise wages, pay its taxes in full, and stop its surveillance of workers. This comes as workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, may soon get another chance to decide whether to unionize. The National Labor Relations Board has ordered a new election after it ruled Amazon had interfered in the first election, in part by pressuring the U.S. Postal Service to install a mailbox outside the warehouse one day before the voting was set to begin. Amazon managers then pressured workers to drop their ballots in the new collection box, casting doubt over the secrecy of the election. The Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union is leading the organizing campaign in Bessemer. RWDSU President Stuart Applebaum said in a statement the new ruling, quote, confirms what we were saying all along, that Amazon's intimidation and interference prevented workers from having a fair say in whether they wanted a union in their workplace, unquote. In March, Democracy Now! Spoke about the mailbox with Michael Foster, a member organizer with the Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union.
Workers just truly believe that something is going on with this mailing box, that why would Amazon want them to bring their ballots from home and bring it to the plant and put it in their mailbox when they can just literally put it back in their own mailbox? People call me and ask me, is Amazon stealing some of the ballots? Because they have seen people put their ballots in their mailbox, and it's just really scary. I believe it's an intimidation, so to speak.
In more news for Amazon workers, New York Attorney General Letitia James sought an emergency court order Tuesday to force the company to implement stricter COVID-19 protocols, saying Amazon has prioritized profit over worker safety during the pandemic and retaliated against employees who raised concerns about their safety. James called for the court to appoint a monitor to oversee worker safety at Amazon's New York facilities. In another court order, James said Amazon should be required to rehire its employee, Chris Smalls, who is fired after he spoke out about working conditions. Well, for more, we're joined by Alex Press, staff writer at Jacobin, host of a podcast about Amazon workers. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Alex. Can you talk about this moment, historic moment, where the NLRB is now apparently calling for a second election, saying that Amazon interfered with the first election in Bessemer, Alabama, at their warehouse? Describe what you know at this point and what happened.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Amy. So this week, the regional director of Region 10, which oversees Bessemer's election, has ruled that they should rerun that election. So, you know, the objections were many that the union filed over Amazon's behavior during the mail-in balloting period, right? So, you know, the voting took place in February and March, and then when the votes were counted in April, a clear majority of those ballots were against unionizing. The problem was that mailbox specifically. So Amazon had set up, had gotten USPS to set up a mailbox in the parking lot outside of the warehouse. And now, you know, Amazon had been pushing for an in-person vote, but it was the height of COVID and the NLRB had ruled against that, right? So this mailbox was seen as an attempt to get around that. So it was under a tent that had all sorts of anti-union slogans on it. It was within spitting distance of the surveillance cameras. And so as the person you spoke to earlier said, the workers themselves felt that they were being surveilled. And the NLRB officer agreed, right? So in their ruling this week, they wrote that Amazon had created the impression of surveillance, if not actually, in fact, surveilled the workers, and also had countervened the authority of the agency. And in fact, even more concerning, had shown it has control over USPS as well, which was tasked with making sure those ballots were not interfered with. So this was a violation of what the NLRB refers to as laboratory conditions, right? You can't have sloganeering at a polling site. You can't have the employer counting or seeming to count and control the ballots. And so those votes are being set aside, and it is likely a rerun will happen in the spring. It's unclear if it'll be in person or mail-in again. That's all to be determined. And Amazon can request that the board review this ruling again. But odds are at this point, you know, the hearing officer in August who had overseen this election recommended a rerun. This week, the regional director concurred with that agreement and similarly ordered a re-election. So the workers were correct. Something was going on. And in fact, it's very concerning for all of us that Amazon could actually pressure a public agency, USPS, to install a mailbox.
And Alex, that's one question I wanted to ask you, whether Amazon has the opportunity to appeal, since this was a regional director's decision, to the NLRB in Washington, and the likelihood of that.
Yeah, so they have 10 business days to request a review. And then the board can, you know, either agree with the existing ruling and reject that appeal and go forward, or it can agree to, you know, sort of countervene this regional director. I would say odds are that this is not going to change, that there will be an election in the spring. But Amazon does have 10 business days to request a review. And knowing anything about Amazon, we can expect that they will, in fact, request that review.
I wanted to ask you, last Friday, Black Friday, Amazon workers in over 20 countries took part in either strikes or protests. The delivery drivers in Italy, garment workers in Cambodia and Bangladesh. Most of these were workers for third-party companies hired by Amazon. Can you explain what happened in these protests and the impact on Amazon of this growing global coalition of its workers?
Yeah, so the Make Amazon Pay Coalition is a global attempt to fight back against Amazon at the level that Amazon operates, which is the global, right? It might be U.S.-based, but it's certainly not limited to U.S. borders, its operations. So Black Friday has become a day of protest. That started last year for Amazon workers. It's spread this year to 20 countries. And that's because Amazon workers hate this day, right? It's their quotas go up, their injury rates go up. They're worked harder than ever during the holiday season while Amazon makes record profits. So it's, they've taken back this fake holiday to stage protests. And so this year, it was all up and down the supply line, all across borders. So as you mentioned, delivery drivers in Italy struck. While they're not directly employed by Amazon, they are an integral part of Amazon's operations, right? Amazon gets around the rights and requirements and responsibilities of employing them, so it doesn't have to deal with those problems, but in fact is using them to get its goods to customers. So they're pretty central to the operation. There were also garment workers in Bangladesh and Cambodia who continued their campaign to get severance that they are owed of some $3.6 million at this Cambodian factory that shut down and promised them severance, never gave it to them. And that factory supplies goods for Amazon, right? We think of Amazon as sort of a marketplace or a platform for third-party sellers. But at this point, Amazon produces many of its own goods and sells a lot of them. And so those were the garments that were being made in those factories. The protests also existed at the level of the proposed Africa Amazon headquarters in Cape Town, South Africa. Communities there are concerned about the development project. There was also a protest outside of an oil refinery in Argentina. That is because Amazon Web Services, the backbone of the internet, as it were, which makes the majority of Amazon's profits, they work a lot with big oil. And so these concerns are not just about workplace conditions, but they're about Amazon's impact on the entire planet, the climate, so on and so forth, the lack of taxes being paid. And, you know, one of the people who is organizing this event, Casper Helderblum, who works for the Progressive International, he told me, actually, he saw a direct comparison between even the Cambodian and Bangladeshi workers and those in Bessemer. He said there have been union-busting campaigns in Bangladesh that Amazon has at the very least turned a blind eye to, which in their form are reminiscent of the struggles we see in Bessemer. So working-class destinies are connected generally, but also specifically in this struggle, right? If Amazon is trying to eat the world, it's also bringing many disparate sets of workers and activists and communities together to fight against them.
I wanted to go to a short video created by Make Amazon Pay Coalition that was released announcing the global Black Friday protests and strikes.
In Germany, office employees are put under enormous pressure, ignoring labor laws. IT workers, click workers, data labelers, and customer service agents are controlled just like their colleagues in the warehouses. The stress is everywhere the same.
The factory fired us in April 2020 and paid me only 700 plus for my 15 years of work.
So there you have that clip. And Alex, as you've written, we're talking about Amazon having a global supply chain. And so the protests are global. Let's talk about the significance of the unionization of this one warehouse in Bessemer, really for the world, what it means. We're talking about a company, Amazon, that's the second largest private employer in the United States, what, around 950,000 workers. What would it mean if the union won?
Yeah, so people might look at this and say it's just one site, right? It's a few thousand workers. That's still a lot of people, but it's nothing compared to that million that Amazon employs in this country. But that's not the case, right? Once workers get a foothold into one workplace, once they get organized, that spreads very quickly. We're actually seeing something very similar at Starbucks, where several stores in Buffalo are trying to unionize, and the company is going all out. You know, Howard Schultz came and spoke to those workers. The CEOs of Starbucks North America are showing up to sweep the floors at those Starbucks. And that's, again, because employers understand that once workers see that they have power, that spreads very rapidly. And Amazon is completely predicated as a business model on total exploitation of workers, complete dictatorial control over their working conditions. This is what Amazon innovates. It really has driven down the standards, has ramped up surveillance. And so if there's any pushback, if workers have any right to push back on that and to negotiate their working conditions, that is, in fact, an existential threat for Amazon. And they're treating it as such. I mean, one thing we haven't discussed is that Amazon, while it seems to have broken the law in Bessemer, much of what it did was legal, you know, spending an unfathomable amount of money on anti-union law firms to come in and train management on how to defeat the union. All of that is legal, and Amazon is spending an immense amount of money on that, and it has started doing that again in this past month in the lead up to this expected ruling from the NLRB. And so Amazon does not want this. It's not necessarily about it can't afford maybe higher wages or something like that, that the workers would win with the union contract. It's really about power itself. It's about maintaining that dictatorial control on which it runs, on which it profits.
And Alex, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that Amazon Web Services are the most profitable part of the company, but most people are not aware of this aspect of Amazon's work, these enormous farms of data, of data processing that Amazon has established around the country and the world. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hidden, right? We all see stories about the warehouse workers, maybe some about delivery drivers, but AWS is a complex beast, right? Because it's hidden. These data centers are, in fact, literally hidden. It's very hard to access them. And in fact, you know, again, it's about us being the product here, right? Our data and our usage of the internet, of every platform you use, most of them are running through AWS. And so Amazon has this trick in its back pocket in that it's very hard to get any kind of, you know, it's not like warehouse workers can organize those facilities. And so the Make Amazon Pay Coalition was hoping to bring more light to that by protesting these, you know, the oil refinery and places like that. But this is a complex beast. I mean, Amazon's whole business model is about becoming infrastructure, right? It wants to become our infrastructure for how we get goods and services through its warehouses and delivery services. It also has succeeded in becoming infrastructure for the internet. And that is its own problem. You know, there are conversations around breaking Amazon up, antitrust law, and it's possible Amazon would spin off AWS to a separate sort of entity from its delivery and warehouse operations. But it's definitely the case that people should talk a lot more about AWS, because that is where Amazon gets its bread and butter. It's where it gets its most profits. And it's where it's really sunk into the marrow of society. And it's very hard to avoid it.
Finally, Alex, the Teamsters Union, one of the largest unions in the country, consists of over, what, 1.4 million members, just finished an election last week for a new president, and they voted in Sean O'Brien, who's been openly critical about leadership being too timid in Amazon organizing and UPS. Who is Sean O'Brien? How could his Teamster presidency affect union organizing when he takes office in March?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because that's a big part of the context when we talk about organizing Amazon, especially in the United States, right? So this is historic. This was a reform slate. That's who Sean O'Brien was running on. So it was backed by the longstanding reform caucus in the Teamsters, which is the Teamsters for Democratic Union. And it's pretty shocking that they finally won. They'd been trying to take out the, you know, the Hoffa slate for a long time. This was the first time that Hoffa Jr. agreed he wouldn't run again, but he handpicked his successor. And Sean O'Brien had once been one of the Hoffa guys. In fact, the falling out between him and Hoffa happened during the last UPS negotiations. So UPS, you know, that contract is the largest private sector contract in the country. There's about 250,000 people who are covered by it. So it's a huge contract. And in the last round of negotiations in 2018, the Teamsters leadership pushed through undemocratically a very bad contract, especially a tiered contract, right? So there's certain workers who get worse standards than others, which is a death sentence for a union. And the majority of the members had voted down that contract, but a very obscure rule in the Teamsters constitution allowed the leadership to push it through. Sean O'Brien was sort of a dissident in that process. He insisted on bringing the opposition into the sort of negotiating room, as it were. And so Hoffa took him off the team. That's when this break happened. And so this is a big deal. So Sean is not a radical by any means, but he is very willing to strike UPS. And that was a big part of his campaign, was that there needs to be a stronger contract. And in fact, that goes hand in hand with organizing Amazon. If you have a strong, organized UPS workforce, those workers can push for better standards across the industry. And they're also in a place to win Amazon workers to a union by demonstrating the benefits of that. So those planks go hand in hand. And really, that is the key, because the Teamsters at their convention this year said that they would focus on organizing Amazon. They're putting resources into that. They're training up rank and file workers amongst their membership in how to organize Amazon workers in their community or near their workplaces. And so having leadership that's taking that very seriously is a big deal. So I think that is the key for the next couple of years of what organizing Amazon in the United States will look like.
Alex Bress, I want to thank you so much for being with us, staff writer at Jacobin and host of a podcast about Amazon workers. Next up, as Barbados becomes the world's newest republic, breaking ties with Queen Elizabeth 55 years after it became an independent nation, calls are growing for Britain to pay reparations for centuries of slavery and colonialism. We'll go to Barbados for the latest.
I believed all of your dreams are duration. You took my heart, all my keys, and my patience. You took my heart, I must leave a decoration. You mistaken my love, I brought for you for foundation. All that I wanted from you was to give me something that I never had, something that you never seen, something that you never been.
Work by Rihanna, the chart-topping singer and entrepreneur who was declared a national hero in Barbados during the ceremony Monday night that marked Barbados' new status as a republic, which we are now going to discuss. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to Barbados, which has just become the world's newest republic, at a ceremony on late Monday night, Dame Sandra Mason was sworn in as the first president of the Caribbean island.
Possessing a clear sense of who we are and what we are capable of achieving, in the year 2021, we now turn our vessel's bow towards the new republic. We do this so that we may seize the full substance of our sovereignty.
Barbados became an independent country 55 years ago in 1966, but Queen Elizabeth remained the official head of state until now. Many other former British colonies, including Canada, Australia, and Jamaica, still have a similar arrangement with the British monarch. Barbados Prime Minister Mia Mottley had pushed to cut ties to the Queen, saying it was time for Barbados to break from its colonial past. The move comes as calls grow for the United Kingdom to pay slavery reparations to Barbados. Ahead of the ceremony, Barbados held a national service of thanksgiving, where Barbados Senator and Reverend John Rogers spoke.
Our seed is one that survived the journey that many should not have survived. Survived 300 years of a plantation system that many should not have survived. Every child born in this country is a gift of God, specially preserved, specially protected.
Prince Charles traveled to Barbados to attend the ceremony when Barbados became a republic. He acknowledged Britain's, quote, appalling atrocity of slavery in the Caribbean. Barbadian singer, actress, fashion designer Rihanna also attended the ceremony, where she was declared a national hero by Barbados's prime minister. We go now to Bridgetown, the capital of Barbados, where we're joined by David Kamishang, Barbados ambassador to the Caribbean community, or CARICOM, longtime advocate for reparations, author of the book It's the Healing of the Nation, the Case for Reparations in an Era of Recession and Recolonization. David Kamishang, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about the ceremony on Monday night and what it meant, certainly far beyond simply a ceremony, the new Republic of Barbados?
Yes, it was a very historic and moving occasion. In fact, for me, it started on Saturday, well before Monday night, when we officially opened our Revolutionary Square. So it was a whole weekend of really celebrating the best of our heritage and our historical tradition. Of course, Monday night was when we installed the new president of Barbados. It was the night on which we bid farewell to British colonial rule. That was symbolized in a very concrete way when the colors, the flags of the military units, the Defense Force and the Coast Guard and the Governor General's colors, they were marched off of the parade ground in view of Prince Charles and to the plain of Auld Lang Syne, that old things were passing away and a new order was being installed. So very, very moving, very historic, I would say. 55 years overdue. It really should have happened on the 30th of November, 1966, when Barbados became an independent country. But back then, for whatever reasons, and there are many reasons we can speculate about, we made two compromises on our constitutional sovereignty and independence. We corrected one compromise in 2005 when we broke our legal system away from the British Privy Council and installed our Caribbean Court of Justice as our highest national court. And so we dealt with the second compromise on Monday when we moved away, not just from the Queen, but also from the concept, from any concept of hereditary rule, installed our own native president, but also a president who is put in place by a democratic process.
And Ambassador, what continues to be the legacy of 400 years of British colonial rule?
Well, the legacy is still there. We are still a work in progress. Barbados was known as Little England. Barbados was, in fact, Britain's mother colony in the Caribbean. The Virginia colony was established in 1607. Barbados from 1625, and because of the sugar revolution was really pioneered in Barbados, and the whole system of slavery-based plantation production was pioneered and perfected in Barbados. The seminal slavery laws of the British Empire were the 1661 Barbados Slave Code, which was subsequently taken to Jamaica and then from Jamaica to the Carolinas and across the 13 colonies. So Barbados was a center of British power, economic power, political power, military power, cultural power. The historians tell you that around the turn of the 18th century, Little Barbados was more important in trade to Britain than New England, Carolina, New York, and Pennsylvania combined. I mean, it sounds crazy in the 21st century, but back then, sugar was like a narcotic drug. And so Barbados developed this system of the production of superabundant profits on the basis of the super exploitation of African labor. So that, you know, it's not going to, you don't get rid of the imprint of that history so easily. So we can still see the colonial era in land ownership patterns in Barbados. There was a landless proletariat in Barbados. Black people were deliberately kept landless. We can see the imprint of those years in the health profile of the current population. Barbados probably has the highest incidence in the world of diabetes and hypertension, the product of centuries of living in a high-pressure environment on those slave plantations, which were really the world's first concentration camps, and being subjected to an extremely deficient diet. And then, you know, you look at the whole, the world's international economic and political order. The reality is that formerly enslaved and colonized nations and people like those of the Caribbean, including Barbados, have been inserted in that international order in a structurally subordinate and exploitative manner. So many remnants of those centuries of enslavement, of colonial exploitation and domination that we're still trying to undo.
And this whole issue of reparations, what are the prospects or possibilities of continuing to press and win some form of reparations, especially in light of the fact that the British Empire, having been one of the biggest in world history, with so many still Commonwealth or former colonies of England, the precedent that would set for the United Kingdom.
Yeah, well, you know, when you have a cause that is just and righteous and rooted in law, you are confident of success. But it means that you must pursue it with passion and determination. Barbados is part of the Caribbean Community. That's an organization of 15 member states, full member states, and 5 associate members. The associate members are still British colonies. The member states, 14 of them are independent nations, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, Guyana, Haiti, etc. And the Caribbean Community really laid the foundation for its reparations claim way back in 2001 at the United Nations World Conference Against Racism. We consciously embraced that World Conference as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to put the issue of reparations, the issue of the transatlantic slave trade and chattel slavery being crimes against humanity, and the issue of reparations on the international agenda. So said, so done. 12 years later, in 2013, our heads of government came together in a CARICOM summit and agreed that we were going to launch a reparations claim for native genocide, or the genocide against the indigenous, the original owners of the Caribbean, and for African enslavement. We were going to launch that claim not only against Britain, but against all of the European powers that were implicated in native genocide and African enslavement. So we established a CARICOM Reparations Commission. That commission is guided by a prime ministerial subcommittee on reparations headed by the Prime Minister of Barbados. And we have made our claim to the national governments of Western Europe, including Britain. Needless to say, our initial approach to them has not elicited a positive response. We have said to them, look, this is the history. This is what you did. You systematically underdeveloped us. You know, you siphoned off our resources, the for generations, the fruits of the labor of our ancestors. You siphoned off to the capitals of Europe. And we are saying to you, you can't simply walk away with your ill-gotten gains. You must come back to the scene of the crime. Sit down with us and let us discuss how you can help to repair some of the damage that you have done.
So, Ambassador,
they have not responded positively thus far. We know it is going to be a struggle. Our idea is that we must develop an international mass movement, an international cause célèbre, similar in size and scope and power to the anti-apartheid movement of the 1970s and 1980s. So it's a work in progress.
Ambassador, this is Prince Charles speaking at the official ceremony where you were in Bridgetown, Barbados, Monday night.
The creation of this republic offers a new beginning, but it also marks a point on a continuum, a milestone on the long road you have not only traveled, but which you have built. From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history.
I know, Ambassador, that it was even controversial for him to be a part of the ceremony. I think there was an organized protest. They weren't permitted on the grounds of whatever COVID safety. But your final message to Prince Charles, to the Queen, and to organizing around the world at this point?
Yeah, well, you know, I think Prince Charles referring to the history of enslavement was very appropriate. Barbados, after all, was the world's first slave society. I mean, other societies have had slavery as a feature, but Barbados was the first society in human history that was built totally on the basis of slavery, its economy, its social system, its ideology. And so that's our history. The royal family was deeply involved in the British slave trade and the system of African enslavement. So, you know, that's the history. So it is good that he had the moral sense to make that reference. I would have wished he would have gone on to encourage the British government to engage in that reparations discussion with Barbados and the other nations of the Caribbean community. He also needs to pay some attention to the role of the royal family and whether the royal family will not have to come to the table as well. You know, we have begun our reparations campaign by focusing on the national governments being the institutional links between the present and the past. But we have, over the years, we have also expanded it to private institutions, banks, insurance companies, universities. I mean, the University of Glasgow has admitted its liability and has entered into a reparations program with our University of the West Indies. And we are going to look at families as well. The National Reparations Task Force in Barbados has just decided that we are going to be doing a special study of the Drax family. Sir Richard, the Drax Hall plantation was established in Barbados in the 1630s. It's still in existence today. The Drax family, the current representative of that family, is Sir Richard Drax, is a member of the British House of Commons and is actually the richest member of the British Parliament. You know, and that wealth came from that slave plantation in Barbados, and then they took it to Jamaica, and of course...
Well, we clearly have to come back to this issue, and we hope to have you on again soon. There's so much to talk about. You mentioned Glasgow. We just covered the UN Climate Summit, and there your Prime Minister, Mia Mottley, gave a remarkable address on the climate catastrophe, which we played in full, that people can find at democracynow.org. David Kamishang is Barbados Ambassador to the Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, and the Association of Caribbean States. Next up, today is World AIDS Day. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Fleet Street Jam by the Bajan saxophonist Arturo Tappan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at World AIDS Day, marked every year December 1st. In a new interview, the head of UNAIDS, Winnie Byanyima, has warned the COVID-19 pandemic may result in an increase in infections and deaths from HIV and AIDS.
Now, COVID has hit us and is pushing us further off track. We saw, especially in the early, the first phase of the pandemic, 2020, we saw disruptions in prevention services. We saw fewer people coming to get the prevention tools, fewer people coming for testing, people dropping out of treatment because they were afraid of going to clinics and lining up for a long time, or they were restricted by the public safety measures. So we saw disruptions, but communities which are the center of fighting HIV are resilient, are innovative. We saw them fighting back and restoring some of these services. But we do expect that in the few coming years, we might see more deaths, we might see more new infections as a result of these disruptions.
That was UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima. We now go to Chicago, where we're joined by Stephen Thrasher, professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, faculty member at Northwestern's Institute of Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being. His forthcoming book, The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. Professor Thrasher, your new piece for Scientific American is just out. Why COVID deaths have surpassed AIDS deaths in the United States. Please explain.
It's really concerning that it's taken 40 years to get to about 700,000 AIDS deaths in the United States. But in less than 2 years, we've surpassed that number. We're already at about 800,000 COVID-19 deaths. It's a very different story when you look at it globally. We're at about 5 million AIDS deaths. 5 million COVID deaths globally, which is much, much less than the 35 to 40 million AIDS deaths that happen globally. So it's really concerning to think about why the U.S. is such an outlier here, and also to think about how can we as a society mourn and effectively think about the people we've lost and deal with our own grief when we're dealing with such an incredible scale of grief in such a little time.
And Professor, what are some of the comparisons, though, when it comes to inequality and the and treatment, whether it was for AIDS or for in terms of COVID, for testing, and then, of course, for the whatever drugs are brought forth to treat COVID?
So your last guest was speaking from Barbados. And if you follow the colonial roots of the United States and England and the global north, you'll find enormous disparities around any kind of health thing, particularly around viruses between the global north and the global south. So with HIV and AIDS, we first noticed it here in the United States in 1981, and we had a pretty big head start. HIV is a relatively slowly moving virus within humans. It can take 10 to 15 years before someone passes away from it. So we have time, and the United States had a lot of time once we got the medication in the mid-1990s to deal with it effectively to make it so that AIDS deaths never needed to happen again. But those drugs took another 7-8 years to even begin to enter into countries like South Africa. And so their death rates continued to spiral and spiral for many years beyond that. Today, there's no reason why anybody should be dying of AIDS. Again, it's a slow-moving virus. And so from the time we know someone's infected, we can give them all the support they need. We have the science for it. We have the medicine for it. It's merely a matter of protecting capitalism and the profits of pharmaceutical companies. And so we're seeing very similar dynamics again now with COVID-19. It's a much faster moving virus, so there's a need to move more quickly because you don't have the window of opportunity to get to people. But we have the vaccines, we have medications that are very effective, and they're again being held from the global south to protect the profits of pharmaceutical corporations. One thing that I do think is significant and gives some measure of hope is that if you look at how marginalized communities dealt with HIV and AIDS, they've really given us the blue blueprint for how to deal with COVID-19. So South Africa, which has been very hard hit by AIDS and by COVID-19, has also developed an extremely sophisticated genomic surveillance network for looking for pandemics. And that's why mutations of viruses, that's why we know to look at this new variant. Similarly, where you are in New York, Amy, the New York City Health and Hospital System had a very robust testing system. That's one of the, at some points, they were doing more tests than the entire National Health Service in England. And so that's one reason why testing was very effective. They've had an extremely good vaccination rollout program. And so you're at about 90% of adults vaccinated in New York, and you had no COVID deaths in the past couple of days. So the blueprints for the places that were very hard hit by HIV and AIDS have given us what the tools and the blueprints of what we need to do going forward with COVID.
And in terms of the lessons of the AIDS pandemic stretching out over decades, are your thoughts on the possibility that we may be facing not 1, 2, or 3 years of a COVID pandemic, but actually decades, especially in terms of the fact of the ability of the virus to mutate and new forms staying ahead of the ability of the medical community to come up with vaccines?
Well, we don't have to have anything like the scale of death that we had with AIDS with COVID-19. It does move faster, and the countries of the global north are dragging their feet and not putting muscle into getting these vaccines and technology and resources to make them in the global south. But if that were to happen, if those of us who are relatively well protected, who have been able to get vaccinated, can pressure our governments and these corporations to do the right thing, this pandemic does not have to drag on for that long. There is no vaccine for HIV. There's effective medications that make not only treatment of the person living with it well, but make it so that they're not likely to transmit the virus onward, but there's no vaccine for it. But there is a vaccine for COVID-19. And so we have the tools to end this pandemic in a much quicker period of time. Whether or not the systems of capitalism and colonialism and borders are going to allow for that is the political question we're facing right now.
So again, to the summary of your piece is really the headline and the subtitle. On World AIDS Day, why have COVID deaths surpassed AIDS deaths in the U.S., and why global COVID deaths are a fraction of global AIDS deaths? Continue on that second point.
I think that countries around the world and societies around the world have dealt largely with COVID-19 better than the United States. The U.S. has had every advantage of time and money and resources. We were rolling out the vaccines first, but we've dropped to 50 of the countries who, in terms of our vaccination rate. So other countries have done better measures. Other countries are not as mobile as the U.S. Americans move around quite a bit. We're still allowed to travel around the world to many places. And we also, this pandemic shows the limits of thinking the United States as a singular entity. So in cities like New York, the pandemic is doing relatively well. In the Deep South, it's not doing very well in places where there are low vaccination rates and without mask mandates. So that's one of the reasons why this has continued to spiral. And I think that we've seen a very different thing with HIV and AIDS, which initially entered into specific marginalized communities, gay men, transgender people who'd been homeless, incarcerated, or were dealing with addiction. And those communities dealt with very specific ways to protect one another and learn together how to protect one another. There was no real such thing as what's called bug chasing amongst gay men, where conservatives would accuse gay men of trying to get the virus. That did not happen from the level of gay activists or leaders in any way. But the opposite has happened in the U.S. with COVID-19. We have politicians and we have radio hosts and conservatives and media who are actively encouraging people to bug chase. They're telling them to go out and get the virus. They're telling them that this is all a hoax. And so that's created a very different environment from how HIV and AIDS played out in the United States, and a very different environment from how it's playing out in other parts of the world, where if other countries have dealt with pandemics like AIDS before, their leaders are not going to be as likely to encourage their citizens to not take this pandemic seriously.
And we only have about 30 seconds, but I'm wondering if you could comment on how China has managed the place where the coronavirus started, has managed to tamp down and almost eliminate the virus.
Yeah, China has had a total number of deaths that are less than some days in the United States. They took seriously the element of time. Once they saw that this pandemic was happening, they put all elements of state power together to stamp it out. And the United States simply has not done that. We have not taken advantage of the time and the resources we have. We're going into getting booster shots for vaccines, and we haven't really done everything that we could do with the first round of vaccines to keep this pandemic from playing out in ways that it doesn't have to.
Stephen Thrasher, I want to thank you for being with us, professor at the MacDill School of Journalism, Northwestern University. We'll link to your new piece just out in Scientific American, headlined Why COVID Deaths Have Surpassed AIDS Deaths in the U.S. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.